Hello again, and welcome to Slap the Chicken. What's this? A second episode? Impossible. As for what we're looking at today, I promised you some details on what the coldest thing in the world was. My fridge is a pretty strong contender, able to freeze a litre of tonic water solid in about 4 hours. Was it a low temperature research lab that my old physics teacher walked by with his mate at some point in the 80s? I'm a little vague on the details of that anecdote because I got distracted by my A-level work. For the true answer, we're going to need to have a look at the science of the cold. Let's start with a temperature we can stand. What's cold with a strange angular appearance and the ability to scupper Britain's entire transport network? It's not Grant Shapps, it's a snowflake. The variety of ways in which frozen water can fall from the sky is large. Among these things, a snowflake is defined as an ice crystal falling from the sky as snow, which has a six-sided, largely symmetrical structure. You may have also seen snow pellets, which are tiny white balls over 2 millimetres in diameter, and ice pellets, which are translucent bits of frozen water, which could also be succinctly described as a pellet of ice. However, today we are dealing with snowflakes. The six-sided structure of the snowflake was something that hadn't gone unnoticed before anyone knew how they formed. The earliest record of this is a companion to a book of Chinese poetry from the 2nd century BC that describes a snowflake as a flower of snow with six petals. This observation was the topic of Johannes Kepler's New Year's present to a scholar friend of his, entitled On the Six-Cornered Snowflake. This was a short pamphlet wherein Kepler considers various possibilities for the presence of this structure before bravely concluding that he did not know. Disclaimer: as a student of the second year Principles of Dynamics module, I'm obligated at this point to wish Sir Isaac Newton a very happy birthday. To quote my lecturer, Dr. Tony Padilla, in his lecture, Newton is Much, Much Greater Than Kepler, Part 1, there's nothing wrong with hailing the great Sir Isaac. This is not a cry for help. A deviation from this hexagonal structure and a great deal of artistic license is seen in the earliest European depiction of snow falling. This is from Olaus Magnus's History of the Northern Peoples, first published in 1555. Please go and look the pictures up. They're marvellous. I will be putting them on the Facebook page as well if you're interested. So how does a snowflake form? The process starts when a water droplet extremely close to freezing point comes into contact with a tiny particle of dust or pollen and becomes solid almost instantly. The real fun starts when the arms start forming. The water molecules start arranging themselves so that they are as close together as the way in which they interact with each other will allow. This results in a crystal structure, whose shape we are going to find out for ourselves. As we're on the second episode, I think it's about time that you drew a clock face. Put a spot at 10, 2 and 6. Draw lines from the numbers with the spot on to the two numbers either side of it. For instance, one line from 10 to 9 and another little line from 10 to 11. You should hopefully have six little lines forming a wonky hexagon. Now imagine three sticks stuck through the clock face from front to back at 12, 8 and 4 to complete the picture. This final addition allows another set of molecules to be attached to this one in the same hexagonal form. When hexagons tessellate completely, they will form an overall structure which is symmetrical and six-sided. forming the six-sided structure of the snowflake. Now, if you look at the clock that you've drawn, you may notice the massive gap in the middle. When water is in liquid form, the molecules don't have to be in this strict hexagonal arrangement, so they can get a little bit closer together. This is the reason why water increases in volume when you freeze it, because of the extra space that exists between the molecules when they are in this hexagonal structure. Although every snowflake is different just like you, due to the almost infinite variety of temperature and humidity conditions that they could form under, the types of shape can fall within distinct groups. Dendrite-type crystal, a stereotypical snowflake image. Six arms with little icy arms sticking out the side of each of them like tree branches. The name dendrite is given to this type of crystal because it suggests a tree-like structure. Thin plate type crystal. Imagine a honeycomb-shaped glass coaster, perhaps made of clear sea glass or the glass at the bottom of a bottle. It's a normal hexagon with no arms or legs. Radiating assemblage of plane-type crystal, six pine trees stapled together by the end of the trunk of each. Merry Christmas. Asymmetrical plane-type crystal. Looks like somebody tried to make a snowflake by putting two different snowflake halves together, but then realised halfway through the process that they were different sizes, so they panicked and bodged it and hoped no one would notice. Bon appetit. Now that was marvellous. Let's move under the sea and see what's going on down there. Our next nippy adventure involves us taking a look at the phenomenon of polar gigantism. In polar climates, people started to find that species, which were usually very small, were growing to extraordinarily large sizes. This ended up being called polar gigantism. This also happens in the deep sea. So why do certain animals experience this? Sea spiders are quite good at being big. Spider is a bit of a misnomer because these lads are far more interesting. They have no lungs, no heart to speak of, and their intestines and reproductive system in any of the 4 to 6 pairs of legs they can have. They also breathe through their legs, through little holes in their exoskeleton. They usually have a diameter of a few centimetres, but in polar climates they can get to a diameter of 70 centimetres. Gigantism has also been observed in sea sponges and microscopic organisms. The people studying this phenomenon tend to focus on sea spiders in the Antarctic, since it's rather common in this species, and they tend to cooperate with you when you try and catch them. The most commonly accepted theory as to why these fellows can get so gigantic is due to the increased oxygen content of Antarctic waters. To conserve energy in the freezing temperatures, the metabolism of the creatures that live in the sea is also greatly reduced. Larger sea spiders have bigger holes in their exoskeletons to get enough oxygen to sustain their big bodies. So it makes sense that an environment rich in oxygen would be good for a vast spider type thing. This may fall apart for organisms which are a bit more complex, so some alternative theories are required. One of these is the absence of predators in this hostile environment, meaning the spiders can get as sizable as they please. Another theory is that the slow currents on the seafloor somehow mean that being huge is better, which would explain why this happens in the deep sea too. To test this, researchers in the Crary's Lab Aquarium made a little water tank with an outboard motor to simulate a current and put some sea spiders in it to see how they coped. The scientific conclusion from this experimental process was that they fell over. The long and the short of it is that no one knows what's going on. When your subject of study lies at the bottom of the -1 degrees Celsius sea around McMurdo Sound in the Antarctic, things do get a bit difficult. Remember, seawater freezes at a slightly lower temperature because the salt molecules get in the way of the formation of the ice crystals we described in the last section. I do have a plan, you see. Now that I've exhausted my synonyms for big, let's have some fun. Would you like something so cold that quantum physics starts to rear its ugly head? Hopefully you said yes, because it's time to enter the realm of cold atoms and condensed matter physics. Start at the bottom with the third law of thermodynamics. This states that no temperature can ever be lower than the temperature known as absolute zero, which is minus 273.15 degrees Celsius and 0 degrees Kelvin. The study of condensed matter physics is largely concentrated on cooling atoms to as close to absolute zero as possible and watching what happens. The effects are slightly odd, but you can't blame the atoms. If some bloke in a lab came along and reduced my temperature that much, I think I'd start behaving oddly too. Cold atom physics includes a lot of fields of study, but for this podcast, we are going to focus on a slightly different state of matter than the ones you may be used to. Each atom in a substance can be thought of as a wave confined to a box. At a high temperature, the wavelength of these atom waves is much smaller than the size of the space between each atom. This means that each wave cannot overlap or interfere with the next one. As the substance gets cooled down, the energy of the atoms gets reduced, meaning that the wavelength of their waves gets longer and the box each wave is in gets wider. This means that each atom wave cannot avoid overlapping and interfering with each other. When they overlap, they add together until the substance can no longer be described as several little waves, but one big wave equal to the sum of all the little waves. This is the new state of matter, and it is called a Bose-Einstein condensate. And trust me, it's very interesting. Mainly because the entire substance now behaves according to the quantum physics, which dictates the behaviour of all of the little atom waves. So quantum effects can now be seen on a large scale. So, how do you cool something that much that this state of matter starts to form? For context, the vacuum of space is about 4 Kelvin, or 4 degrees above absolute zero. We need to go at least 1 million times colder than that. Let's strap in and follow the method used by the team at the University of Colorado, who were the first to produce a Bose-Einstein condensate on the 5th of June 1995. Don't try this at home. When an atom has heat energy, it will vibrate in position. At absolute zero, the atom does not vibrate at all. This state is impossible to achieve because there will always be some transfer of heat energy from the surroundings to the atom, making the atom vibrate. We therefore try and make sure that the atom is vibrating as little as possible. The researchers trap some rubidium gas in a magneto-optical trap. This trap consists of 6 laser beams with a magnetic field applied across the trap. The laser beams all intersect where the magnetic field gradient is equal to zero. What do the laser beams do? If you remember the photons from last time, you can imagine that the atoms are getting bombarded from all directions by little packets of energy. Imagine having 6 people standing on the corners of a hexagon, here we go again, with you in the middle. When you try and leave the hexagon, somebody throws a ball at you with such force that you get knocked back into the middle. Now imagine all 6 of them hurling balls at you with quite an alarming frequency. You'd be hard pushed to rock side to side on the central point, let alone go anywhere. This is what happens to the atoms, but with significantly less bruising. Why do the laser beams have to cross at the point where the gradient of the magnetic field is equal to zero? To explain this, we need something called the Zeeman effect. If you were here last time, you will remember the energy levels of an atom. You will also remember what I said about physicists and naming things. When an atom absorbs energy, it gets excited to a higher energy state and quickly falls back down from that energy state to the initial ground state. When it does this, it kicks out a photon with a photon energy equal to the difference between that ground state and the state that the atom got kicked up to. What the Zeeman effect does is split the higher energy state. This means that the atom doesn't have to gain as much energy to get to the energy state that allows it to kick a photon out. The lasers used produce photons which have enough energy to excite the atom. The Zeeman effect is proportional to the strength of the magnetic field, so it does not occur at the point where all the beams cross and the magnetic field gradient equals zero. As the atom moves further away from the point at which the gradient is equal to zero, the magnetic field and the Zeeman effect get stronger. This means that the likelihood of the atom being able to kick out a photon will increase. Kicking out this photon pushes the atom backwards a bit because of momentum conservation. So if the atom tries to leave the spot where all the beams cross, it'll kick itself back into the spot. And oh, that's just the first step. The atoms, which are now trapped by all this, can be cooled further by evaporative cooling. So how does that work? Imagine the region where the atoms are trapped as an egg cup with several green peas inside it. What we're doing in this analogy is taking some very sharp cutting device and lowering the height of the egg cup. This means some peas will fall out and there will be less peas in the trap. The peas which have escaped correspond to the more energetic atoms in the trap. This means that the overall energy of the atoms still in the trap gets lower, so the atoms within the trap will get lower in temperature. The cutting device here corresponds to a radio wave applied across the atom trap. As the frequency of the radio wave is steadily lowered, the walls of the trap get lower and lower until it is cold enough in there to form a Bose-Einstein condensate. Hooray! The researchers at Colorado used this method to take rubidium atoms in a gaseous state and cool them to 170 nanokelvin, which is nearly 2/1000000ths of a degree above absolute zero. But why? Why are we doing this? Why are we here? Well, with a Bose-Einstein condensate, you can make an atom laser, which can be used to etch tiny circuit patterns onto chips, reducing the size that the chip has to be and increasing their computing power. It's all good fun. As to why we are all here, I don't know about that one, Chief. And there we are. The end is nigh, and this podcast episode is finishing pretty shortly too. New beginnings await like an egg waiting to hatch. Next episode, we will be exploring this egg and the chicken it came from in a desperate attempt for this podcast to actually live up to its name. As one of the most long-awaited New Year's Eves in history looms large, let's hope some bit of 2021 is at least 1% better than anything that happened this year. Disclaimer. If you find a snail, then put it in the fridge. It will live a little longer than average.